This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
Every space that one of your listeners takes up at this event, and a Pauline Hanson supporter won't be able to get in the door, should they try to do so, and I wouldn't count on them not.
This is Sonia for Broad on Joy 94.9, and we're talking all about Feminist Writers Festival. It is impending, it's coming. Melbourne will be hosting the very first one. And to coincide with that, we have on the phone line the wonderful Shakira Hussain, who'll be speaking to us about what her involvement is in the festival. Welcome.
Hi, Sonia. Good to speak to you.
Excellent. So can you just let our listeners know a little bit about your own background and what's brought you to something like the Feminist Writers Festival?
Yes, actually, we've been corrected on that. It's the first of this iteration of the Feminist Writers Festival, but there has been a Feminist Writers Festival in Australia.
Oh.
Sometime before. Yeah, longer ago for us to have been particularly aware of it, but
oh,
it isn't
okay.
The first one that's happened. It's the first of this manifestation of it.
Oh,
but
okay. Fair enough.
But this manifestation of it, we are hoping and planning, will become a regular event.
Mm.
Not necessarily always held in Melbourne. We do want it to be a national event too, so future festivals are likely to be held in other cities. That's something we're still
cool.
Working on.
And so what's your own background here as a writer, as a contributor to this amazing festival?
I'm an academic based at the University of Melbourne, and I write mostly about issues connected with Muslim women, but not only. I've also been writing increasingly about disability. But similarly, I was going to say self-centered, but self-centered in the sense of arising from my personal experience, because I have multiple sclerosis, and initially I thought that this was a disease that, like middle-class white people, or women more than men though, so there's that feminist angle to get multiple sclerosis. I figured it doesn't arise out of any particular social injustice. I wasn't and not disabled because somebody like bombed my village or neglected my community and didn't provide sufficient medical care, so I thought this isn't really my topic, but as it's become more and more a part of my life, I've revisited that, as I said, initial thought that I wouldn't actually ever bother to write about it, so I have been. But still, I write mostly about gender issues and issues around racism, and racism against Muslims in particular, racism towards Muslims, which is becoming more and more widespread and more fraught.
Yes, that is very noticeable, I think, globally, Australia as well, of course, and you have been, your involvement there, of course, is in some of your writing, I see, that through looking at the experience of being a Muslim woman in Australia.
Yeah. Yep. And talking with other Muslim women and Muslim women elsewhere as well. And yeah, and I did my PhD fieldwork in Pakistan, and my book opens with a couple of chapters arising from encounters in Pakistan, and then moving on towards the experience of Muslim women living in Australia.
Yes.
Afghan and Pakistani women, but
specifically
based in Pakistan.
Okay.
Yeah, Afghan and Pakistani women, first of all in Pakistan, and then Muslim women in general living in Australia.
Excellent. Yes, your book, it's called From Victims to Suspects, Muslim Women Since 9/11, has been something...
Very reasonably priced, available at all good bookstores, or they'll order it in for you.
Oh, actually, will you have it at the festival? Will there be copies?
Yes, there will be.
Very important, because it is something that... When you do look at some of the photos that are there, I was looking online about a woman in Kabul. There was the article in The Australian that showed a picture of a woman in Kabul during the 1970s compared to more recent times. The contrast is quite, well, very obvious, I guess.
The 1970s Kabul was women in miniskirts, or some women in miniskirts, showing women as being free, and women now, well, not wearing burqas, but much more covered up as being not free, but most women in Afghanistan were never you know, walking around Kabul wearing miniskirts and the various regimes under which Afghan women have lived. How women were dressed hasn't borne a huge relationship to other areas of their lives and how oppressed and, you know, they were at any given time. That's often used as a measure.
Yes. I notice that usually those pictures there of universities, aren't they? People who attend the universities are usually the ones they show in the 70s, I noticed.
Yes, so that doesn't speak to the... particularly in Afghanistan as compared to, say, Egypt, where the role of the central government has never been all that strong over the rest of the country. And so women, most Afghan women do not live in Kabul. Most of them live in rural areas. Mm. And for most of them, their lives were governed by local, often just at a village level, never mind at a larger provincial level. But yeah, so it was very, very, and under the Taliban as well. The Taliban never controlled the whole of the country, and a lot of the Taliban's most notorious edicts about dress or whatever were not ones issued from some central authority in Kabul. They were ones issued by local Taliban, you know, councils or leaders, not imposed over the whole country, which is not to say that they weren't, you know, very onerous for the women who they did affect, but that it's a misconception to kind of think of it as some central authority handing down these rulings.
Exactly. I guess it's the selective media at what was happening and what is happening. We don't see it a lot now, of course, because, again, it's that selection that they make of what is newsworthy.
Yes, we didn't hear as much about the bombing of the Medicine Sans Frontières hospital in Kunduz in October last year as we really usefully could have done.
There was very few images of that, which makes me wonder, do they halt the images, you know, slow them down, or is it just not getting covered?
Yeah.
But I guess that's another topic, sorry. Going off topic. Now, one of the topics you are covering, I believe that's on the 26th. Friday the 26th at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. It's called the Feminist Writers Festival Networking Day Program, and it's really chocker with some really good stuff there, and you've been part of that. I see one of the sessions is titled Mothering from the Fringes. It includes yourself, Anastasia Kanjeri, and Miriam Sved. I probably said those both wrong.
And I'm not in a position to correct.
Okay, I might edit that.
Excited to see that Anastasia Kanjeri has been shortlisted for the Scribe Nonfiction Writing Award for writers under 30 for a piece that arises out of the topic that we're talking about, a piece written that she wrote about her response to new-ish motherhood. So, I'm really pleased about that.
So what will that... So what does that topic mean?
I'm struck by just how narrow our concepts of motherhood are and how if you deviate from them from in the slightest, even if people don't disapprove, but they act as though it's a political statement in itself. And so I was like, Anastasia, although she's in a stable heterosexual relationship, but her partner is not white, her baby is not white, she is visibly white, and people, I remember sitting on my own white mother's lap in a doctor's surgery, or rather I've been told that sitting on my own white mother's lap in a doctor's surgery, and the doctor coming out and looking at me and saying, "Where's your mother?"
Oh dear.
And seems to be this pattern, having spoken with other women, that if you're a white mother with a brown or black child, it's like international adoption. If you're a brown mother with a fair-skinned child, and my daughter is more fair-skinned than me, people think you're the nanny.
You're the help, or you're not. It's really disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, and people advising you on how to, telling you that that child will get sunburned, which you wouldn't obviously know anything about, so you're going to have to, on a hot sunny day, I do know about sunscreen. I use it myself, even.
Yes.
But, yeah. And then on top of the template, there's also, as I said, as I developed multiple cirrhosis, that made mothering more complicated. And again, treated as though it's some particular project you've taken on rather than mother having a child in those circumstances. I mean, other than just doing what everybody, doing what if women don't do it, that's considered not normal too, just having kids and raising them. You know. And Miriam, sorry, in this conversation, Miriam has a daughter with her same-sex partner. So again, that's something that's viewed as like, you know, whether approvingly or disapprovingly, but a statement rather than just leading your life. You know, and I'm interested in talking to Anastasia and Miriam about how their feminism helps or doesn't help, whichever, them to navigate that, and whether it's shaped or been shaped by their experience of mothering from the fringes.
Yeah, no, it's pretty confronting when you do see that. I was part of, I guess you could say, international adoption, although it was in New Zealand, hardly international, but I was raised by a white couple, and it was always the question of, and they would always be trying to say, you know, she does look a bit like you, to my, you know, adoptive mother, and though we look nothing alike, and people would just try all these very strange, trying to make excuses for their own inability to just mind their own business.
I've witnessed this with other people. I can see she's got your facial expression.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. I'm a single mother too, I'll just add to that, which is, again, you would think just commonplace enough to be normal now, but still somehow is or not as normal as you would expect, not regarded as normal as you'd expect.
Yes, that's pretty much in our community too. There is that aspect as well. You'll get a lot of same-sex partnerships, and like you were saying before, the other writer that will be present on that panel with you, it can be very awkward, not so much for, I guess, the parents, but certainly from, I guess, outsiders who are clueless about how there can be so many different forms of family. We're raised on that whole idea of the nuclear family and the impact that has.
Yeah, and if you don't have it, then you're supposed to somehow create, or not create it. If you don't fit that template, then you're supposed to smooth away the rough edges until it does look more
until
normal.
Until it's suitable to them, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you're supposed to adjust in that regard. Mm. And I'm interested also in hearing from Anastasia about dealing with, like, I get asked quite often by white mothers who have children with partners who aren't white about how they should deal with raising a brown or black child in a racist society, and, you know, how to navigate that topic, which sometimes, again, there's pressure to just normalize that and to just say, oh, well, it's only skin color. You know, so it's invisible and it doesn't matter. Mm. And I don't see race. To me, people are just people and children are just children. I do not believe that race is some biological determinant, but we do live in a racist society.
Yes.
People's identities are racialized. And, you know, it's as we don't live in some kind of utopia where you just don't notice it or acknowledge it.
Well, you can never assume that anybody else is going to be thinking along those same lines. In fact, obviously they're not, because we have a racist society.
And a child growing up in that, just because they have at least one white parent, is not going to, their identity is going to be affected by those racialized stereotypes that are imposed on them, and you can't just wish that away. Which
you can't
is
buffer
that,
it as well, I guess. You can try. But that's kind of, yeah, in my opinion, it's fails the child often.
Yeah, and you know, as I said, I'm interested in the many, many ways in which women, when they have kids, face this expectation of, you know, making their families and their lives and their offspring, you know, conform to a particular norm, and by people who don't regard themselves as narrow-minded or as hostile to anything outside that norm, and yet the way of dealing with what's seen as deviations is like to either say they don't see the difference, even though it's there. And
I know exactly what you mean, having experienced it myself in a way. It's a different. It's best to know the realities, I think, when you go out into the world, to know that you've got love and support at home, but to know that there is the reality that people will show you and tell you what they think of an interracial or a non-normative family. They will let you know one way or the other. You'll get bullied, or you'll get harassed, or you'll get treated, you know, accordingly.
As them rather than us.
Yes.
And sometimes
always the outsider.
Yeah. And then sometimes, often finding it among other people who are them and being in, and communities in which you're part of us rather than them, even if the people around you are not treating you as other. Mm-hmm. But like, there's you can relax a bit when you're not.
It's another thing, you don't have to fight or be defensive, because it is a bit like having to defend yourself all the time or defend your family.
Yes. And having a space in which you can express anger at those experiences instead of minimizing them, even among people who will say, oh, that's dreadful, I'm so sorry, that's so prejudiced, I wish you didn't have to go through that. And yet there's sort of this, I mean, which is an expectation we can impose on ourselves, that, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, we're, you and I, we're buddies, and we're the same, and we, you know, and it's not stopping us from communicating.
Now, just to jump ahead, because on the following day, you're going to be a very busy woman. It's a busy time for that weekend, but we've got Muslim feminism, and that's Saturday the 27th. That's going to be part of the, it's at the Footscray Community Arts Centre. Can you tell us a little bit about what that will be covering?
Dominique Tui is a psychologist primarily, and so and her book is an online ebook, and it arises from her experience with patients, in my understanding. Eliza Vitri Haliani, an essay of hers which was published in the Griffith Review. She grew up in Indonesia, and she talks in the particular essay that I've read about her experience of being sent to an Islamic high school, which she was initially very angry about, but her parents sent her there for the quality of their education rather than to, you know, because of any strong level of religiosity on their part. And yeah, it's a quite funny and refreshing and interesting essay. So I'm really looking forward to reading the book as well.
Cool.
And yeah, so I think to me, it's Muslim feminism kind of sounds as though you're harnessing your Muslim identity to your feminism, which is not the way I conceive it. I think of myself as being Muslim and feminist, don't refract the one of those labels through the lens of the other, which, like, there are, and I'm interested by what you do refer to as Islamic feminism, but that's a feminism that methodology is primarily theological, and Susan Carland, many of your listeners will know, as a broadcaster and writer, as well as just having completed her PhD at Monash University, is publishing a book on that topic next year, which I'm really looking forward to writing. But that is about women who are revisiting the Islamic texts which have been deployed in a patriarchal way and saying, oh no, that there is a long history of reading this in a light that doesn't oppress women, that is a feminist take.
Oh, interesting.
And that there's a history of, like, female leaders and female...
Oh, that'd be cool. Kind of like reclaiming.
Yeah, which is something that interests me, and I find some of their... Particularly Amina Woodward, who's an African-American Islamic feminist, and others I find... And Sisters in Islam in Malaysia has undertaken a similar kind of enterprise. Mm. And I find their work really, you know, exciting and interesting, but that isn't what I do, because I'm not a
okay.
And there isn't just one way of undertaking feminist practice among Muslim women, and and I'm a sociologist.
So I guess it's the diversity, looking at the diversity that is part of identifying as Muslim, and if you are Islamic, would you say Islamic Muslim for those who are more religiously,
following,
inclined.
You know, and I'm not anti-religious, but it's just not the particular. It's a lot of work to become that familiar with the relevant text. Well, you have to have good Arabic for a start, and good classical Arabic too, not just conversational Arabic. So, if growing up in an Arabic-speaking society or community doesn't mean that you still don't have to, you know, doesn't give you immediate access either.
There's some real, I should imagine, some real challenges there, and it's an interesting discourse, I would imagine, too.
Yeah, so the three speakers on that panel, we're all coming from quite different starting points, which is not to say that we have any, I expect there to be any serious disagreements. But yeah, we're bringing different experiences and to this particular conversation.
It sounds very exciting, very exciting. And it's certainly, I would hope you'll get a lot of people going to that one, and the discussion will, you know, branch on, move on and evolve from that. So And also it's good that Monique's there too, I guess, looking at appropriate, says here, access to culturally appropriate services for her, you know, psychologist background. That looks very good too.
Yeah, and I'm glad also to have a panelist who has that experience of growing up in a Muslim-majority society. Mm. Because I have to say that, like, part of Western power is that even if you grow up on the margins of Western power, part of Western hegemony is even if you grow up in a marginalized position within that hegemony, your voice is broadcast disproportionately once you do start to speak into other societies. Mm. So that the journalist who was became very prominent during the Arab Spring, and because she was arrested and sexually assaulted and spoke out very strongly against the regime and subsequently against the Islamist, against the Mubarak regime and the Islamist government that replaced it. But she has interesting things to say, but she has a much more prominent position and her voice is much more prominent within Egypt, not just within the United States, because she's been based in the United States for a long time, and because she's published in the New York Times and broadcast, you know, on American TV, that gives her a kind of global profile, which women based in Egypt who don't have the level of fluency in English and in English language experience in English language media that she does. And so Muslims living in Australia and elsewhere in the West are used to conceiving of ourselves as always being like marginalized and our voices not being heard. We can be unaware of the fact that actually if you're in, you know, a Muslim majority society, the voices of Muslims coming from the West are like this big freaking booming megaphone, you know, really more than our fair share of space there.
Stereotypes, would you say?
And I'm conscious of this when I go back and forth to Pakistan, that I'm used to and have written about, and producers have written about, the way that Muslim particular voices speaking out against, well, the Taliban, say, or against religious authorities in Muslim-majority societies, those voices are appropriated for the purposes of U.S. imperialism. After 9/11, the voices of Afghan women who were speaking out against Taliban oppression were appropriated for the purposes of justifying the U.S. intervention, particularly when it became clear that, you know, they weren't going to be able to claim victory by killing Osama bin Laden, or not for another decade. Mm. And so instead, the victory was that they had liberated Afghan women. And that's been much discussed, you know, among Muslims and among other activists who are opposed to U.S. imperial intervention, which I also am. But we should also be aware when we speak out, our voices, when we're based in the West, when we speak out against the likes of Bronwyn Bishop and Jackie Lambie, who want to stop women from wearing the veil, that that gets appropriated by religious nationalists in Muslim-majority society. And I've also talked in my book about the case of Malala Yousafzai, who our youngest ever Nobel Prize winner, who survived being shot in the head by the Taliban, you know, which is a case that, of course, has been used and predictably has been used to justify U.S. drone attacks against Taliban targets in Pakistan. But we don't know how many civilians are killed in those attacks.
Yes.
And Malala herself has said that drone attacks are just creating more terrorists. Mm. But that message, which she has, you know, also, and which she gave personally to Barack Obama when she met with him, gets far less attention in the West than her denunciation of the Taliban.
Yes.
You know, which, I think I can get quite angry actually with anti-war activists whose cause I basically support can be unaware of the ways in which their critiquing of the Malala narrative plays into this story, this anti-Malala rhetoric within Pakistan, you know, which is also, you know, by people who actually, you know, either claim that she wasn't shot at all or claim that it was in some way morally justified.
Mm.
And they're unaware, or to my mind, insufficiently aware of the fact that it fits that narrative of hate speech against her, like a teenage girl who was shot in the head going to school. And like, if you want to critique drone attacks and say that the victims of drone attacks get insufficient attention, well, that's really good. You know, then do that. by drawing attention to those other stories, by drawing attention to the stories of the victims of drone attacks, which are not easy to come by. It's dangerous and practically impossible to get to those areas, but at the same time, their testimonies have been collated. Some of them have met some survivors of drone attacks, and their relatives have managed to travel to the West, as have their legal representatives, and that does not get attention. If you could want to put as much time and effort into platforming those stories and drawing attention to those stories as you did to saying, you know what, that Nobel Prize winner, she's not such a big fucking deal, is she? The US is using her to boost their own attack. Look, give her a fucking break. We know that. This has been going on for like a decade and a half. We should be used to that. And, you know, and that's not actually particularly clever or particularly...
No, it's not helpful. You
know, it's, no, it's not.
It's not helpful. Know, just get and why use and, her? That's not fair. Well, do you know? It's just not fair as well. And it will cause other types of harm, like you were saying, back on the ground level, you know?
Yeah. So, clueless. I mean, but again, again, Malala speaks good English. Malala's in the public platform. Yeah. It takes a little bit more effort, but it's not impossible to locate the stories of, you know, drone attack survivors and to highlight those and to campaign around those than it is to kind of say, oh, you know what, Malala's not all that.
Yeah, well, they need to back off, don't they? Because she's doing what she has to do, and it's not fair to attack her on that, you know, like you were saying, because it's just they don't understand the bigger picture, you know, because we don't see enough of the other parts of those same pictures, but from a different viewpoint, you know, it's a different view of the same picture.
Yeah, there's a bit of old-fashioned celebrity bashing comes into it.
Oh, yeah, it's pathetic. I can't stand that. I just go, I'll back off, you know. You try being in her shoes for, you know, that's what I say to people who criticise her. I go, just try it. You just think for a moment, you be in her shoes and what happened. I mean, seriously.
No, it comes as a surprise, I think, to people outside Pakistan of how much of a hate figure she's has become to people who they wouldn't expect to like, well, female students her own age and tertiary educated women who they expect will be Malala fans, and they're not. And that comes as a surprise, and sometimes then they take that as showing something profound and showing something, which just is commonplace among women of that demographic, is like, well, why is she famous? She was shot in the head because she took a particular stance. She was shot in the head because she dared to stand up for something. And she survived being shot in the head. You know, it's not something that you do for a lifestyle change.
Yeah, no.
To get a scholarship to study in the UK. You
know. Yeah, it's very mean, and it's just a conspiracy theorist pop up. And I'm thinking, no, it's just part of that picture that they don't see. It's like a whole range of things, and I'm sure there are many Malalas that we don't know about. And
I'm interested in the way that these global narratives all play into each other as well. So in my writing, in my book in particular, I talk about in Pakistan, because that's the Muslim majority society with which I'm the most familiar, but also a lot of Muslim women living in Australia, because that is the society where I've lived
my whole life.
I'm interested in the way that events in one of the, you know, location have more than ever ramifications in another one, and the way that what is said in one location is appropriated or distorted or echoed or, you know, in another.
It's been great, though. Really, really important. And I hope that more people will certainly go along to that discussion that's been held on the 27th of August. It's 1 p.m. at the Great Community Arts Centre. Pretty easy to find. You can just Google map that. And it's called Muslim Feminism. And you yourself, Shakira, will be one of the panellists on that. So I think that'll be fascinating. Does it go for an hour, or I suppose it's an hour?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, cool. I'm sure many people get a lot of benefits from that and learn a lot. And it's also
free. If your listeners could all turn up, then they will hopefully be less space for any Islamophobic, you know, ranters who want to disrupt it. And that is a priority for me. So, you know, come along.
Do
please.
You think there
Assuming
will be?
That you're not an Islamic. It's becoming a pattern, I
is
have
it?
To say.
Oh, damn.
I mean, there was only one, but he managed to
disruptive, you know, enough. Yes.
Yeah, at the launch of my book, you know, it was because it had been described as being like feminist and Muslim, and that was what she was on about. How could I possibly? I must want to circumcise
little girls. How can you have? You can't have feminism and Muslim. You can't. That's the angle they take. It doesn't make sense, and it's interesting how they're men as well. It's like, oh God. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry to all our male listeners out there. We're not anti-men.
Turn up so that Rise Up Australia can't fit in.
Exactly. And we're not anti-men. Don't worry. You can be a man and be going along to things like, you know, stuff about feminism. It's just fine. Everything's fine.
Yes. If every space that one of your listeners takes up at this event, then a Pauline Hanson supporter won't be able to get in the door, should they try to do so, and I wouldn't count on them not.
Oh, goodness. Oh, they really need to do something else with their time. They really do. Well, look, it's been fabulous speaking to you again, the second time here on Broad, but this time in much more depth, and it's been fascinating. There is so much to think about here, and hopefully after the Feminist Writers Festival's over, and don't forget the Melbourne Writers Festival too, in conjunction, I think there's going to be a lot of people getting interested, hopefully, in writing their own words and finding out more about the things that are important, the things that we talk about. So, yes, thank you very much, Shakira Hussain.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And good luck with what's going to be a really busy weekend coming up.
Yeah, thank you.
On the 26th, 27th and 28th. Are you doing anything on the 28th, or are you having a bit of a break to enjoy some of the panels?
I suspect I will be flaking out on the 28th.
Flaking out. Okay, well, but thank you so much for speaking to us on Broad.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune in to us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy. For feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.